Hi, I'm Tina Desiree Berg, reporting for Status Quo News. And this week on Right Wing Insanity Report, we're going to look at the topic of right-wing extremism and sports. This is probably something that hasn't crossed your mind, but it has been used as a recruitment vehicle for the last decade to pull people further to the right, suck them into the neo-Nazi movement and whatnot. So here to talk with me today is Chuck Mody. You know Chuck's work. He is a sports columnist. He's written for Deadspin, New York Daily News, but he currently covers social justice issues. And I think this makes him uniquely positioned to have really good knowledge and opinion on what we're discussing today. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Tina, great to be here. Great to see you.
So right off the bat, I wanted to talk about the Rise Above movement and Robert Rundo, because he was recently extradited from Romania. He's been brought back to the United States to stand trial for several federal charges. He had flown the country, you know, a couple of years ago, was in Serbia, moving around Europe. But, you know, Robert Rundo is sort of the quote unquote father of the active club movement here in the United States and abroad. Active club movement is basically neo-Nazis get together and they do boxing, MMA matches. They try to turn it into more of this like tough guy lifestyle, make it appealing. So they're using this as a method of recruitment. I would say that Robert first saw this with a guy named White Rex, who is Denis Nikita, who is a Russian neo-Nazi who is actually in Ukraine now, but we'll table that for a moment. So Denis started this whole White Rex movement in Russia and in Europe, where he started having MMA boxing matches that were whites only. Robert went to Europe, to one of these things, got the idea to bring it back to the United States, and he did so. So I wanted to, before we get into this, I want to play a couple of clips so people have an idea sort of what we're talking about. So these are kind of propaganda clips that are out there for various active clubs, because they're all over the United States now, literally every part of the country. Honestly, it's kind of funny. So they juxtapose this guy doing weightlifting with, you know, the white chicken, the baby, family values, traditional values, whatnot. So that's clip one. And let's go ahead and play the second one, too, and then we'll get into the conversation. So Chuck, what, you know, I mean, sports can be a beneficial thing for the world, right? It can be edifying. It can be building people up. It could be involving community, all kinds of edifying things. But these guys are finding a way to turn it into a form of hate.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
That's what happens. Let's just start here for a second. But let me just set a context, just in America. I'm a little more well-versed in America, but this applies around the world. The top 100 shows with the top 100 ratings, 75 of those top 100 in 2021 were the NFL. In 2022, 80 of the top 100 were the NFL, and by far. So we have to understand the currency and the mass appeal that sports has. And the reason I say that is that Nazis understand this.
Right.
The police understand this. So you see these pageantry of police. The military understand. The Department of Defense pays billions to the NFL to recruit by having military people honored. And I don't know if people fighting for human rights understand that. And I know that because when I'm in my certain spaces, when I'm at protests, they say, well, you know, why are you involved in sports? And I say, well, why are you not? Because we're just all talking to each other right now. So what I think is it's they know, the white supremacists know to use these platforms to uplift white supremacy. And we have to denounce that. We have to fight that. We have to point it out like you're doing. And we have to invade those same spaces and fight that and then come with our own messages about love and about human rights.
Right. So part of the reason White Rex was motivated to do what he did is because prior to him creating these whites only MMA tournaments, white guys were not dominating the sport at all. Yeah. They were getting their asses kicked. And he felt that that was sort of demoralizing for, you know, the white race. He was already a Nazi. So this was just, you know, an added thought he was having. And it just sort of morphed into this other thing and took on a life of its own. You know, now you see like Fox News is saying, why are Southern Poverty Law Center, why are some of these other organizations that have been reporting on this, why are they saying that fitness is bad now? And that's not the case that's being made here at all.
Yeah.
Fitness is good. I don't think people that are fighting Nazis think fitness is bad. What they're suggesting is this is being used as a tool for recruitment to get people sucked into these extremist movements.
Yeah, and especially in the climate right now, because first of all, I mean, white supremacy and male supremacy, they go together. They're hand in hand. Right. I mean, you know, in the last few years, there was a racial awakening. There's a George Floyd uprising there since Ferguson. There's also a Me Too movement going on. And what you're seeing right now in the quote unquote anti-woke movement is a white lash, backlash, whatever you want to call it, to that. Yeah. And you're seeing the convergence, you know, even the Proud Boys, right? It's a white supremacist group that are men. They want to act like men. And they are recruiting this way. And you probably know better than me, because when you were talking and you were saying they're all around the country, I'm almost like, tell me more, Tina. Tell me more how much they're all around the country. Because like, I may be even underestimating it, right? I know about the rallies that get attention. I don't necessarily know what's going on behind closed doors and that you're investigating in message boards.
No, that's right. So, you know, on Telegram, you'll see many, many active clubs, like literally Ohio, North Dakota, Evergreen, which is, you know, the Pacific Northwest, other ones in Oregon, Rose City, you know, they're everywhere, Nevada, in the South. So there's probably, I would say, at least 100 active clubs in the United States right now. Mm. I don't know that the membership in these groups is a huge amount per group, but I don't even think that that's the point. I think part of, you know, what these guys were originally talking about is it's safer if you're in a smaller cell anyway. Like, do we really want to draw? I mean, look what's happening with Patriot Front right now. So. Yeah. So for them, it makes sense. I do have another video I want to play. This is Robert Rundo, the guy we're talking about. So he's literally sitting in prison right now here in Los Angeles. But this is him talking about why, you know, how he was motivated to start doing this. And I also want to point out, notice the tattoo on his elbow. This is a this is a Nazi tattoo. All right, let's go ahead and play this clip.
Today, the FBI says this man, Robert Rundo, is the leader of a white nationalist group that...
Talk about who Robert Rundo is.
Within MS-13, Rundo was known as El Diablo Blanco.
What's going on, guys? Rob Rundo here with the Guidelines to Rise, the Media to Rise project. Another weekly video. This one is, I'm going to be talking about because I've been seeing all these, you know, all the footage from the BLM riots and all this stuff. And one thing that I've noticed in a lot of these is that you have people, they get surrounded and then they get pummeled and they have a look of shock every time that they get punched in the face like they didn't expect. Like the mob is surrounding them, screaming at them, and for some reason they are totally surprised and shocked when they get punched in the face or just totally unaware or don't put up a fight or just have their hands by their side. And I mean, I've seen so many videos like this of just people just completely like a deer in headlights. Like you have a pack of people surrounding you, ready to attack you, ready, like you can, you know it's going to happen. And for some reason, these people just act totally surprised every single time it happens to them. They stand there like a deer in the headlights. They don't put up a fight. They don't try to do anything. They just stand there and just let it happen. And they end up getting, you know, a lot of these videos we've seen where people get extremely hurt, you know?
Okay, so this is Rob basically saying that the BLM riots, are the anti-fascists and the BLM people are attacking them, surrounding them, beating the shit out of them. That's not reality.
No.
What kills me about that, though, is they always seem to have this sort of victim mentality, right? No matter what it is, they're the victim. They could be the instigator in a million different ways, but they'll find a way to sort of make themselves victims.
No, I mean, it's absolutely right. And in any, listen, two of the most mind-blowing experiences I've had was in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And in January, on the lawn in January 6th. And the reason is, in between those and long before those, I've covered over hundreds of protests like yourself, but usually the racial justice protests. Yeah. And, you know, you'll see black people or white people stand with black people get arrested and mass killed for anything, including manner of walking. And it happens all the time. And it happened all throughout the summer of 2020, a mass arrest of over 200 people just for violating curfew, 437 arrests the first 4 days. And then the two major exceptions were not just white people, but were white supremacists.
And in
Charlottesville, you had a group, and my friend, Revolutionary Z, some folks may do, he does really good work. He was there too, and he caught the Nazis pushing up against the police and like shoving them real hard. And he was yelling, "This is white privilege. This is white privilege." I correct that. This is white Nazi privilege. And it's even higher. And they clearly had a stand down order. The police clearly had a stand down order. That order came from above. And to this day, we've never made that connection. And then now fast forward to January 6th. And, you know, I probably witnessed 13 tear gases for almost all 13 for no reason. There are many more on Black Lives Matter Plaza. I witnessed these mass kettles. And on January 6th, I was like, where's the tear gas coming? When's it coming? I was sitting here for an hour. When is it coming?
Right.
Like, there's a little smoke bomb. And then we're like, oh, it was pushing it back. And then someone must have gotten the order, no more smoke bomb. It must have been a direct order. So, I mean, we have to talk about the connection between the white supremacists we're talking about and the white supremacists in blue. Right. And to your point about the absurdity and this absurd logic, what was so interesting on January 6th, now we're getting past 6 p.m., and they could have mass arrested everyone just on curfew charges to 10,000 people. They could have easily done it, got their ID, let them off the next day and have that and go back to the tape. They didn't do that. But my point is, I saw this privilege, and it was so interesting because I saw these white supremacists and Trumpers yelling and start sounding like Ice Cube, FTP, yelling at them. And just 5 minutes ago, they were back the blue. They were back the blue. For giving them 5% of what folks on Black Lives Matter got.
Yeah, 5%. I agree.
I really felt you should have been with us. You should have been on our side. Now think about what I'm just saying for a second. That you have white supremacists shocked that the police weren't fully on their side. I mean, on their side to the point of they'd have to get fired on their job. That many were on their side to the point of not getting fired on their job.
Yeah.
And you're like, this level of privilege that you just think you have access to the Capitol. It was amazing to watch. It was amazing to watch. And I'm going to tell you something. I would have been up in that building if I didn't make a pact with a friend that we were going to stay together and they didn't want to go in. And to this day, I don't know if I regret that or if I'm lucky, because who knows what could have happened. You know, I'll never know.
No, it's true. I want to play a second clip. Now, this was put together by ProPublica back in 2017 or 2018, I believe. This shows the Rise Above movement. They were in Charlottesville, which you were just talking about, and that was absolutely crazy, right? So here you had Nazis fighting with police, and the police still weren't arresting them. They also attacked a group of Orange County registered journalists in Orange County at a Trump rally. They hit a girl. And then Berkeley. So this is some of the sequences that the FBI is using to prosecute him now. But this is he's literally engaging in the type of activity that he's accusing BLM of, is what I'm sort of getting at. So let's go ahead and play that.
If anyone wants to know, this is what we're about. It's Rise Above Movement.
Say the 14 words.
Oh, man.
They would not have joined. They would not have joined.
I'm a big supporter of the 14, though. I'll say that.
Hey, knock it off. Bro. Knock it off.
Don't push me.
All right, so just so people get an idea of who these guys are, and it's interesting that ProPublica is sort of making the point that you were making. Local law enforcement did nothing when they behaved in this manner. They let them do it.
Yeah.
And in fact, there were local Huntington Beach police there when these guys were beating the shit out of a journalist, which is insane. So anyway, but now the FBI stepped in, investigated, brought this Rundo back from Romania. He's in jail. So we'll see what happens next. I think the trial is going to start in December. But there's definitely a sort of a separation that happens with reality. The reality is these guys are the ones that are being violent. They're the ones that are surrounding people and beating them up. They're not the victims. They're not.
No.
But it's sort of this white grievance thing, for lack of a better word. Yeah. Like we're the ones that are downtrodden, even though you've been in charge of the universe for the entire humanity, like the length. Like I don't. It's like silly, right? But here we are. Yeah.
But I mean, I also think a lot of that has to do with media. Okay. I love the work that you do. I really, really do. And we last ran into each other in Atlanta for the Stop Cop City movement. And that was a very important movement to cover.
Yeah.
But you know what? The work of uncovering fascism, uncovering Nazis, uncovering police terror, this is happening from a few independent journalists. And then on the other hand, you have this right-wing machine.
Right.
And what would happen is if something happened, if I was on the street and there was some, Daily Caller people, people just totally twisting the story or finding one angle which did not represent what was actually going on, that would go up a ladder and within like 5 minutes, Tucker Carlson's got the footage. And I saw that happen. And I saw it on the web. So the initial footage comes from someone on the street. But when I do something or you do something, there's no ladder for it to go up to hit mainstream outlets, hit corporate outlets. You know, it's not going to happen. And you may get it if you only focus on Nazis. But the second you try to make the connection between Nazis and police, then it stops.
I agree. It's over. Check. Let me point this out. only point this out because you're not wrong on this. And specifically about the Orange County journalists that were getting beat up in that video. Yeah. So an anti-fascist stepped in and pepper sprayed the Nazi guys. And it wasn't just Ram guys. There were guys there from Goyim TV holding up literal swastikas. So these were not just Trump supporters. They were hardcore Nazis, and the Trump supporters didn't seem to mind their presence. You know, and they had anti-Semitic banners like Goyim TV does. So anyway, an anti-fascist stepped in and used some pepper spray to get the fight to stop, and they pulled the journalists out. This is actually what happened. But you know what made it to the local news and then ran its way up the chain? That a Trump supporter got sprayed by red pepper spray.
Yeah, I believe
that is it. They interviewed her because she was the organizer of the rally. The one that got some of the other guys that got pepper sprayed didn't open their mouths, but this woman who was the organizer did, and she made it about her and being a victim. Mm-hmm. No, but my question is this: local news media, are you kidding me? These are other journalists getting beaten up. Why wouldn't you investigate that a little more? Find the video that proves that this fight was started by a Trump supporter. Why wouldn't you do that? And instead, you've changed the narrative. And now forever, if you Google this event on your web browser, it's going to come back with this Trump supporter saying, "I got pepper sprayed by Antifa." That will be the story.
Right. And I've seen this all the time. And then like what I'm saying is, like, if you cover Nazis, there's not a wing that is uplifting your independent journalism. There's just not. So you have a few independent journalists, and then you have billionaires. And the problem is, then take like an MSNBC. The only time either Nazism or police terror has value is if they could tie it into pushing Democrats forward or pushing a Biden forward or doing, if it could help. So Charlottesville, they're all over Charlottesville because it was hurting Trump's, you know, ratings.
Yeah.
So they could cover that at that moment of time. But the same news station, like a CNN, that was saying Trump's bad, they were the same people that uplifted him to the presidency by normalizing him and treating all his bigotry as okay. So it's really, do you have a profit motive? And they might have a profit motive as Trump the villain, and they might have a profit motive in uplifting Trump, but none of that has to do with Trump being the bigot or mobilizer of bigotry that he is.
That's right. I agree. You know, and here's the other way that they profit. They won't send a news crew to Charlottesville. They know what's happening, but they don't want to pay for security to protect their guys.
Yes.
Then after they're not there and all hell breaks loose, they start sliding into people's private mentions and asking them for free footage instead of paying them what they could for this.
Can I confirm what you're saying?
Which is so offensive. Yeah.
Well, let me confirm what you're saying.
I've had CNN ask me for free footage. But go.
No, that happened to me all the time. But at this particular time in Charlottesville, I'm writing for the New York Daily News. I do sports writing, but every once in a while I might go into a different department. And they know I'm going to Charlottesville. I'm going to Charlottesville that day. And I'd ask, was anyone interested? No, nobody was interested in covering Nazis, right? And we had an agreement. They know what I did. If I cover a Free Palestine rally, they're not interested in that, but I'm still going to do it on my own. So I go to Charlottesville, no interest. I'm about a block away when Heather Heyer, rest in peace, freedom fighter, gets murdered. Once she gets murdered, my phone's blowing up on the New York Daily News. Can you interview people? Can you have witness people? Well, you know, I was here all day, and you could have asked me if this was important. Why did she have to die
for it to be important?
For this to become important. Now it's important. And don't be wrong. I did interview people, gave them the story, and they did compensate me, which didn't even cover the trip. But the point is that this is the only way you could get on media. I always wondered if Heather Heyer does not get killed, if what's the man's name who drove the car, James something, if he doesn't,
Jason Fields.
Yeah, Jason, if he doesn't drive that car in there, and that was, I was right next to DeAndre Harris, who was getting beat up by three.
Which was insane. Yeah,
I was literally right there. I was running with my camera to it. And I saw it. I saw DeAndre has blood coming down his face in the stairwell right after it. I have the most gruesome picture. I never released it because it's that gruesome. I say all that to say is that if those couple things didn't happen, I don't know if even Charlottesville's a national memory. It might go by the way of Shelbyville, which was a Nazi riot a couple months later, everyone's forgotten about. Or there were ones that happened before it or in D.C. I think the only reason Charlottesville gets its prominence is because Heather Heyer was killed.
I agree.
And Trump was president. So national media will get behind it to hurt Trump, who they previously helped.
Yeah, I don't disagree. You're not wrong on this. What about guys like Andrew Tate? Here's another guy. He's more of a manosphere guy. He is, facing charges now for also, and wait for it, Romania, for human trafficking and rape. But this is a guy who became famous with extreme misogyny. Also an MMA.
He's disgusting.
Also an MMA fighter, right? So he had been a professional fighter. Like, what is the appeal? What I don't understand about Andrew Tate is, what is the appeal here? Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, he's now been indicted on both human trafficking and rape. So he's basically holding these girls hostage in this house. They're performing sex work for him on these webcams. He's taking all the money. But he's really popular with young boys, which is really devastating and disturbing. And I don't understand why. Why do you think that is?
I mean, that's the biggest problem right there. You could say how disgusting this man is, but we have to wonder why young people are flocking. Why are young boys flocking to him? And, you know, I don't have a neat answer, but I do believe he is part and parcel of that, this sort of the growing anti-woke movement that is going on. When you have dominance, when you have privilege, and who has more privilege than white men? When you have that privilege, giving it up feels like oppression. Equality feels like oppression. Removing that dominance feels like victimhood, when it's actually not. It's equality. So what happens is, from a psychological point of view, what you're seeing is, we're going to reclaim our dominance. Mm. And Andrew Tate is like the most, you know, ridiculous, absurd, misogynistic, racist expression of that. I mean, you hear his quotes. I mean, if you went online right now and you said Andrew Tate quotes, you'll see 10 worst quotes by Andrew Tate, 30 worst quotes by Andrew Tate, 50 worst quotes by Andrew Tate, 100 worst quotes by Andrew Tate. This is I couldn't even begin to start. But I'll start with something that isn't actually is doesn't even hit the top 100 of how bad a quote is. And is that he justifies it with the Bible. He says, the Bible, you know, the men had many women, the women did not. So when he justifies the dominance of men to have many women, but not in reverse, he cites the Bible. And there's a long history of citing the Bible and equating it to oppression.
That's insane. Yeah, it's insane. You know, I just hope that that gets righted now that he's him and his brother are facing some jail time here. Because the influence over our young men could be very devastating for their futures. What are they going to grow up to be, 17, 18, and think it's okay to rape girls when they can't find ways to communicate with them properly?
Yeah.
Because that's what they're learning. They're learning how not to respect women, how not to communicate with girls. And that's really bad.
That's true. And I want to read the quote to you, Tina, though. He says, read the Bible. Every single man had multiple wives. Not a single woman had multiple husbands. It's against the will of God. It's disgusting. this is what he believes and what he's selling.
It's what he's selling for sure. Yeah, I don't know. And, the things that he puts on Twitter, I know, he had been banned from Twitter by Jack Dorsey, and now Elon Musk has brought him back. But honestly, that's also why he got into trouble and he's facing jail time. He got, his ego was deflated by Greta Thunberg and he just couldn't handle it. Right. So he put up a video. He put up a video that was able to help him be geolocated. So,
He's a disgusting human being. He is a disgusting, and I'm being nice by calling him human being.
I want to turn now to probably a subject that most Americans don't know about, because, the United States of America, when we look at football, we have American football. That's our popular pastime. Yeah. In Europe, it's soccer. It's different. They call that football as well, but soccer is really the main sport there. There's been a movement, I'd say, for the last decade there called the ultras or the hooligans. Yeah. And it's also neo-Nazis and sports fanatics getting together, and they've been used in devastating ways. to further various causes from both Ukraine to Yugoslavia, genocides, whatnot, to other things. But I don't know that people are aware of this. So I wanted to first go through this. This is Harvard, if we can put this up, Colin. This is Harvard International Review. Fanaticism and the Ultras Movement, how far will you go to support your team? I want to just talk a little bit about this so people can get a background on what this is. Okay, so violence erupting in the stands between rival supporters, skinheaded neo-Nazis clad in black, frenzied fans lighting iridescent flares that engulf entire soccer fields in smoke, the ferocious intonation of drums galvanizing players and teams. These are but a handful of the images frequently associated with the transnational ultras movement of global soccer fans. But do they tell the whole story? Have these hooligans and their fanaticism been misunderstood? I don't think so. The politicized social phenomena cannot be confined to meek and dismissive outsider analysis. The ultras constitute much more than a sum of their often unsavory parts. The Italian movement with a right-wing twist, there's a little consensus on when the ultras were first recognized by the international community. Although the Torcida Split fan group of the Croatian club Hajduk Split is generally considered to be the first organized ultras, the movement actually first gained popular support in Italy, where ultras rose to prominence during the 1950s and early 60s. Globally, the objective of the ultras is to foster an intimidating atmosphere for the opposition while motivating their own team to victory. So 1950s, 1960s, early on, they hadn't really, I don't think, morphed into what they are today until about, I'd say about 10, 11 years ago. I wanted to play a clip, actually, too, while we're doing some background on this. This is from Vice News, because they did a deep dive into this decade of hate. I'm going to play a few minutes of this so people can see some of the footage and hear a little bit about that.
Football, the planet's most loved sport. But for all its beauty, camaraderie, and joy, some of its hardcore fans have a pretty bad rep for violence, bigotry, and hooliganism. Ultras, casuals, hooligans. The definitions change depending on where you are in the world, but they're all seen as the most devoted, fanatical followers of their club. They're often highly organized, following their teams around the world to show support, and occasionally to stage hyper-violent pitched battles with rival hooligan firms. This kind of impassioned, near-religious support is really seen outside football, except in one place, politics. This is how, from London to Belgrade to Jerusalem, right-wing movements and political parties have attempted to co-opt the testosterone-charged energy of the football terraces and turn it into a ready-made weapon to silence opponents. My name's Tim Hume, and I cover the far right for Vice World News. It goes without saying that the majority of football fans aren't hooligans, but far-right infiltration of football is a long-running problem. It has its roots in the earliest days of hooliganism in the UK of the 70s, where organisations like the National Front would deliberately try to recruit new members from football terraces and the pubs that surround them.
When I was a teenager and I was on the terraces, you know, you would see the National Front there, you know, you would see them trying to recruit, you know, they would have their leaflets and so on. Join the
National Front! But the crossover between football and extreme nationalism reached one of its most violent expressions during the breakup of Yugoslavia in the 1990s. Željko Reznatović was a seasoned criminal and worked as a security guard for the players and coaching staff at the Serbian club Red Star Belgrade. When war broke out in the early 90s, he formed a paramilitary group called the Serbian Volunteer Guard, or SDG, and recruited from the Dalije, Red Star's hardcore supporters group. Reznatović was nicknamed Arkan, and the SDG became known as Arkan's Tigers. The Tigers were involved in massacring large numbers of Croatian and Muslim civilians.
They're closely involved in ethnic cleansing operations. Basically, what we see is the Tigers being used as a force to perform the dirty work of the Belgrade regime.
So what we're getting at here is extreme nationalism, right? So the National Front in the UK, yeah, in Great Britain, this was a neo-Nazi organization. You saw them, you know, doing some Sig Heils and goose stepping there for a little bit of that. Yeah. They didn't show a lot of it, but the National Front was absolutely a neo-Nazi group in the UK. But a lot of these groups are just really super nationalist, so which, yeah, is why it would make sense that they would get involved in genocide in Serbia, whatnot. Yeah. But how is it that that comes into play with soccer? It just seems not, it doesn't seem intuitive if you're just looking at this and hearing about it for the first time. Like, how are these things gelling together?
For me, it does seem intuitive. I mean, because if I want to spread my message of hate or any message, I want to invade sports, you know, and listen, and I'm going to come right back to your question. What Colin Kaepernick did, yeah, is he took something we've all been fighting for in the streets, and he made people deal with it who had every opportunity to close off police terror from them. And then you're fighting in different spaces. And so sports is, particularly for white men, not only white men, but sports, it's his escape. It's his getaway of violence, of a cesspool often of racism and misogyny and homophobia. And all that's part of sports, right? And you have to combat it. So if I'm a white supremacist, yeah, I want to use sports. Here's the, I think that there's a little bit difference in America. I don't put that on the Nazis. I put that on the profit-driven soccer teams. Because we've hit a point through protest that if like a fan, I think it Russell Westbrook, the great basketball player, he was called a slur, that fan is gone for life. He could never come in here again. They'll say, well, you can say what you want. You paid for your ticket. You're gone. And some soccer teams in recent years have had a no tolerance for hate policy, and you see that. And so there's been that movement. There's been some progress from the anything goes in the 70s.
Yeah.
But that has to be everywhere. So when I see a bunch of Nazis in the stands, you know, saluting Hitler, I want to go to the owner of the stadium. I want to go to the owner of the team. And yeah, we have to hold them to task and hit them in the pocket if they don't do something about it.
Yeah, no, and because there's been video like that. You'll see video of these guys, yeah, like all stand up and start doing Sig Heils in the middle of a soccer game. And you're like, what the fuck am I looking at? Because it's just crazy. But yeah,
they want that money. They want the money.
Yeah, so they let it go. They let it fester. And now you briefly heard the Vice News guy even say Israel. And this is going to sound completely bizarre, but there is some ultras there now that are in one of the settler areas that have created a little hooligan thing there in Israel, and they're ultra nationalists.
It doesn't sound crazy because Israel, particularly in the last 15 years,
is nationalistic. Yeah,
has gone to the right of Trump. Right. You know, I mean, you know, Netanyahu is to the right of Trump.
100%.
It's gone so wild. You don't get me started. So what you just told me does not surprise me one bit. Yeah.
It's like a disease. It's nationalism. And I've said this before, nationalism can be like a virus, like a disease. It's like if everybody starts, you know, digging into their own little bunker and saying only my people can be here, fuck everybody else. Yeah. It becomes very hate driven really quickly. And that can spread and cause violence. But you know, interesting. So we've got like 70s National Front going up into the last, but I'd say it just got really bad the last 10 years with the ultras. Yeah. They are also organizing on Telegram. You'll see all kinds of ultra Telegram rooms where you can go into, and there's all kinds of Nazi propaganda and whatnot. So now that we've looked at the right-wing extremist problems related to sports, mm-hmm, but they're not the only ones. I would say there's a lot more widespread softer racism, quote unquote softer, meaning it's not Nazis. It's your average guy just being a racist schmuck. You know, that's obvious. You know, we can see with, you mentioned Colin Kaepernick. Let's talk about him for a second. Yeah. I think, you know, he stood up to that. We're right now at the 7-year anniversary, actually, this week of Colin first taking the knee. It is amazing. 7 years. And I think he forever changed the way this has been playing out. So I wanted to pull up this this Microsoft article, 7-year anniversary. This was just 2 days ago. 7 years ago today, then San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick took a knee during the national anthem for the first time. In protest of police brutality and racial injustice in the United States, Kaepernick sparked serious political discourse and furthered meaningful conversations that are still too relevant today. Kaepernick's girlfriend, Nessa Diab, shared on an Instagram post in honor of today's anniversary, "We are still with you." He really did change everything, but look at the price that he paid in his career. I think actually you were one of the first sports writers to really sort of talk about this.
Yeah.
From a social justice perspective, right? A lot of people were slamming him.
2 days after his kneeling. Yeah. I wrote an article in New York. I wrote about many articles in New York Daily News, and he noticed. And I, you know, I think people were getting off topic, and what the money line he said. They were trying to make it about a flag. But what he said is about police are getting away with murder and going on paid vacation. That was the money line. Getting away with murder. What don't you understand? And the kneeling came a few weeks after his first comments on social media, which followed the back-to-back murders of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile. And he was like, wow. And he had two social media posts attacking it. And, you know, if you've seen these videos, it's indefensible. And they did get away with murder. And Blaine Soleimani, the police officer who did murder Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge, got a paid vacation for like a year. And nothing happened. And there's so much video evidence. It's so damning. I have my own theory about that in that he was going to take everyone down, so they let him off the hook. But having said that, this is what got Kaepernick going. But I want to go back a couple of years, because but back a couple of years, we're in Ferguson in 2014, and there were five protests at the Rams Stadium when the Rams were still in St. Louis, some inside, some outside. And the big one was on Monday night. I was there in a whole bunch of protests, and we did a banner drop, Black Lives Matter, on and off the field. I've always wondered. Kaepernick was on the opposing team, and this made some national news. You know, did that have any impact? Did he see that? Yeah. But the bigger point is this. When I'm on sports shows, people always say they want the next Kaepernick, or who of this will step up, and which big athlete or which big celebrity. And if you actually analyze social movements, it's the people that force the celebrity to speak up. It's the people in the street of George Floyd that forced the celebrity. And that's not just true now. That's true going back in the 60s. Maybe the only exception is Muhammad Ali. But everybody who spoke out in the 60s were impacted. If you talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar having a boycott, he was caught up in the 1964 uprising in New York City after a police officer shot a young black man. And then he goes to UCLA and there's the Watts riots. He can't escape it. This all informed him. He couldn't be in a bubble if he tried. Not that, and then he was a 7-foot black man, which is very hard to do anyway.
Hard to miss him, yeah.
Yeah. My point is this. We can't wait for saviors. I love Colin Kaepernick. But if you want more Colin Kaepernicks, get in the street and force those Colin Kaepernicks to amplify what we're already doing.
Right. And, you know, he did. I mean, what is your stance on this? I feel like he did pay a price for that.
Oh, yeah.
His career could have been so much better, longer, whatever.
He gave up his career. He gave up millions of dollars.
Let me ask you this, because you're an expert in this and I'm not. Is this because of the owner of the team? Is this because of the NFL? This is pressure from other players. Like, what is the nexus of that?
Well, first of all, it's collusion. When owners, and it's illegal. A lot of people don't know collusion is illegal. When you all get together and you say we're going to blackball a player. A lot of people think owners care about winning first. Owners care about profit first. Okay. So what Kaepernick was doing was, in his grievance of racial justice, we got to get rid of him. Forget that he can help our team. You know, there are a number of teams, particularly Denver Broncos, could really have used him, maybe get to a Super Bowl if they had him.
Yeah.
But they're worried about their money. They're worried about maybe a bunch of white people leaving. NFL is also a more right-wing sport than, say, baseball and basketball, and which all they have its own, you know, issues. But really, you know, I would say the Trumpers are the majority of football fans. You're really going into Trump territory. If you go to – have you been to a football game recently? Like, if you go, it's disgusting.
Not like, for a while. It's been probably 4 or 5 years.
I wouldn't take – if I had a kid, I wouldn't take a kid. You go to a Jets game, it's disgusting. The chants that are coming up, it's disgusting. And it's not for the family. And it's just one of those things where these owners, and you have to understand the owners are also maybe 90% hard right wing.
Right.
You know, Jerry Jones, you see him in the picture. You see him giving $500,000 to Greg Abbott. This goes for all of them, maybe outside the Rooneys in Pittsburgh. This is who they are. And the only reason black players are on the field is that they can make profit for them.
Yeah, wow. So, yeah, so it's collusion. It sounds like it's a host of things. Definitely. So Trump is like at the center of so much of this in this modern time, you know, not 10 years ago, obviously, but right now. And I feel like in many ways, when he ripped that Band-Aid off of other parts of the country for the racism, he did so probably with, sports and football, too. I don't think that's going out on a limb to see that.
Yeah, he used that platform. He used it brilliantly. Trump is a marketing genius. I have to give him credit for that. I don't want to hear the word genius and Trump together.
Yeah.
But he plays his adversaries. Yeah. Most people who hate people are not going to like this. Most people who hate Trump help Trump. They may do it unwittingly by needing therapy and get him on TV 24/7. Because all that publicity only helped them. The bad publicity helped them. The good publicity helped them. He was running at 1% when he said Mexicans are rapists and announced his candidacy. And then everybody jumped in for the high ratings, covered him nonstop, and made him the president.
That's right. I don't disagree. I mean, all of that stuff that the left wing sees as disgusting for good reasons, and it is disgusting, let me just say that, the people that he's talking to, they see him as his hero for saying it. And so when that message gets amplified, it brings them out of their hiding places, so to speak. Yeah. So I don't disagree with what you're saying at all. I think he got a lot of free publicity. I also think the DNC made a huge mistake when they decided to go with a Pied Piper candidacy, like thinking Trump was not electable. Let's let that happen. Let him get promoted. Let him, get more media attention.
That's what they did.
That is what they absolutely did. They didn't see that had a bad consequence. Like they didn't perceive the tenor of the country or the temperature in the country at that particular moment.
They did not. And many of us, when he was a Republican and before he beat Ted Cruz, we were at rally. I was actually, I believe, to my knowledge, the first rally was in March, I think 2019. It was in New York City. And then there was a succession of them.
Yeah.
And we weren't protesting Trump running for president. We were protesting the rise of bigotry. Whether he won or whether he lost, he's bringing bigotry with him.
That's
almost separate from electoral politics. And so you have to look at him in a little bit as a carry, who's a mobilizer, right? And when you're a mobilizer, even without passing laws, you can impact change if you believe that culture precedes legislation, as I do. Culture, and on the left wing, you see very few figures even in history. So you could have a Barry Goldwater in 1964 who could lose in a landslide, but impact the next 50 years of racist Southern strategy and white thought. And you could have Trump lose an election and has had much more of a cultural impact and effect of the next few years and what's happening in local races and local politics and banning books and all of this, even though
lost. So no, that's right. I mean, you're not wrong. He's definitely.
Wondered, what if Bernie lost? What would be like? What if Bernie ran, but there was this movement, and he lost? What would could the movement do? Like, say, thank you, Bernie. We don't need you now. What could that movement have done to change some laws?
A lot more than being stuck in the primary, for sure. Yeah. I agree with you there. Do you have any other thoughts on right-wing extremism in sports? Or, I mean, here on Right-Wing Insanity Report, we don't think only Republicans engage in right-wing insanity.
Oh,
sometimes the Democrats do too.
Oh, yeah.
across the board, it happens.
Well, I can answer that. I think, I've covered Nazi rallies for a long time, and I will continue to cover them, and I love the work that you do, and I love everybody's out there. You have to do it. You just have to. There should be a 10-to-1 at every Nazi rally. And if every complacent white person just got the hell up, we could shut it all down. So we got to do it. And I got to give love to that. But at some point, when you don't see people playing defense, if I go to a Knick game, I'm a Knick fan. There's a time a crowd boos. You don't boo if they're, Knicks fans do, but you don't boo if they're just shooting bad. Bad example. But when you don't see, when you really get booed, we don't see effort. You don't see someone hustling for a ball. You don't see going for it. So when you see year after year, for years, I'm like, oh boy, the Democrats, they just have to be smarter. They just have the better messaging. They have to fight harder. And then you get to a point, well, I don't think they're actually trying to fight. I think they're letting this happen. And then you realize, you look at some of the corporations that are tied, and you're like, yes, that's what's happening. So then you're focusing, because these white supremacists are going to be there. I want a defense of the white supremacists. Because I don't think I'm going to flip it Trump or through reason. I mean, it's going to take a real long time. But if you're so supposedly aligned with me, then why aren't you fighting back? And fighting back isn't just hating Trump all day.
No, it's doing something, changing policy-wise. You know, I think that if there was less income inequality in the country, if the Democrats actually did something to address that for once, instead of just giving it lip smack, that would make a difference. Fascism always increases in times of uncertainty, of worry about financial security.
Yeah.
And that is, I mean, we have worse, financial income inequality right now than we did in the 20s. It's really bad. And some people can't work two jobs and make ends meet. That's insane that this is happening anywhere in the country. And it is. So I think that's partially true.
And 100%. We were just in Atlanta. Yeah. So this is to your point. Yeah. We know Brian Kemp is a white supremacist. We understand who he is. We understand he's going to arrest 42 people and gleefully throw people in jail and give them domestic terrorist charges and happily do that. Yeah. I expect nothing less from Brian Kemp. I'm not going to try to reason with Brian Kemp. But when we see the Atlanta Democrat City Council aligning with Brian Kemp, having the same policies as Brian Kemp, maybe not as loud, more muted, but at the end of the day, doing the same things and having Tortuguita executed and having SWAT raids on food supporters, a journalist. Now we got a different kind of problem. I got to know why the Atlanta's not playing defense. I got to know why Atlanta's sounding like Brian Kemp. I want to know why Atlanta, the home of the civil rights movement, are acting like having a Nazi platform. And that is a little harder to fight because you're fighting billion-dollar corporations who fund them. But I feel like... Okay. That's what we have to also focus on as well if we want to stop right-wing extremism.
I agree. And I think people are – here's what I worry about. I think people are aware of that. They feel the pain that the Democrats are not doing anything to fix the problem. They've supported them blanketly for several years now in hopes that they would, and that hasn't happened. So now there's – what worries me now is there's anger towards the Democratic Party for good reasons, valid reasons, and I don't see the Democratic Party doing anything to fix that. My worry is that what happens when a lot of these individuals that feel like they've been patient and nobody's sticking up for them get so angry and pissed off that they're, you know, ready to become accelerationists in the same way the right wing has. If that makes sense. Like, this is a perfect storm that this country's in right now. And I worry that as messed up as our democracy is, and it's pretty messed up, I get it. We have, you know, regulatory capture, corporate donations are out of control to Congress. Our Congress is bought. We can go through all those problems. We discuss those problems almost every day here on Status Quo.
Yeah.
But the reality is if we topple our democracy, what comes next could be a hell of a lot worse and a hell of a lot more fascist and not an improvement whatsoever. And I just know that at some point, the emotional anger that takes over, people don't think clearly about those things. And so I worry, you know, I think SCOTUS is another prime example of this. It has no public trust for good reason. We have corruption to the core. I mean, Clarence Thomas, why isn't he being impeached? Why isn't Samuel Alito being impeached?
Yeah.
They're obviously making politically motivated decisions. Roe v. Wade was 100% politically motivated, not grounded in precedent. So the reasons people don't trust public institutions are valid. Like, all of these things are valid, but what happens next is what worries me.
I don't know exactly what happens next. I know we have to fight. I think the right wing, what they do. Listen, doesn't it feel, even though Biden's president, doesn't it feel like we're still moved more right during Biden? Doesn't it feel that way?
Yeah, we always move more right. That's it, right? It's a ratchet effect. Even when there's a you could have a Democrat in office and we incrementally move to the right. I mean, look at from where we've been since FDR to if we're just looking at, you know, economic policy, like today, it's like, it's insane. The privatization, the tax cuts, end of Glass-Steagall, you know, destruction of unions and workers' rights. I mean, just go down the list of things that have been a desired list from the right wing, Powell memo forward. And they've been checking those boxes off.
Yeah. I've heard the remark that we're Reagan is on his 11th term right now.
Yeah. That is like perfect. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know who said that, but you know, kudos to them.
It's good.
It is good.
It makes sense.
You're right. You're right, Tina. I mean, you're right. It's just, but I think what I'm saying is that when stuff, when there's a Obama becomes president, the Tea Party blows up and they start acting
locally.
And even they were shutting, before Roe v. Wade, they were shutting down Planned Parenthoods everywhere. They were already doing that. And then when Biden becomes president, you're seeing this huge backlash, and they were operating locally. I don't know what it is about Democrats, liberals in general, that they wait for, like, they think one day every 4 years is important, and they don't operate locally. They're not trying to change things locally.
Yeah,
which they could.
Right.
You know, and I was fooled during Trump. I thought we were on this renaissance of resistance. Of I saw George Floyd. I saw anti-immigration protests. I saw white people come out like I'd never seen white people before. Like, we're all these Tinas out here now. And it was a beautiful thing. Yeah. And I remember 3 days after Trump was elected, I went to a surge meeting showing up for racial justice, a bunch of white people who, you know, fight for racial justice. And there were only 30 surge people there in D.C. Trump was elected. I went that Thursday. There were 300 white people there.
Wow.
And there was something about Trump as, you know, how boorish he is, how bigoted openly he is.
Openly bigoted, yeah.
Openly bigoted, that really brings up white people. But the second he was gone, Joe Biden, I'm sorry to say, became a sedative to that movement, to the anti-bigotry, when they thought the problem was solved because they didn't understand what the problem was. They had a problem with a man. They blamed Trump instead of Trumpism.
Right. Trump is a symptom of a disease, right? He was the natural outcome of what was already happening in the country.
That's right.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, we'll see what happens in 2024. This is going to be a kind of a nasty, nasty election cycle, I think.
It will be. I'm going to tell you right now, I know how you folks feel, but I'm pulling for Dr. West because he is talking about all the things that are important to me. So whatever happens, I want to amplify those messages against police brutality, those messages to stop Cop City, those messages for a free Palestine. And I would love to, if he gets 15%, he could be on a debate stage and he can say, Donald Trump, get off the crack pipe. Joe Biden, get off the crack pipe. This is what is happening in Palestine and we're funding it. This is what is happening in Atlanta, Cop City. We're funding it. This is mass incarceration. I've been to the jails, been in there for 41 years. Have you seen what's going on there? You haven't. And these are the conversations that I would love to see on a national stage.
I would love to see him on the national stage, too. If the one candidate that I most align with political thought-wise is definitely Dr. West. Yeah, that goes without reason. I think Robert Kennedy Jr. is a non.
Oh, he said some awful things.
He's
about
awful. He's
Israel
horrible.
And Palestine.
He says awful things about everything. He's a crazy conspiracy theorist. Yeah. I mean, the anti-vaccine shit. Like, get out of here with that. Like, yeah, there's. I don't. Yeah.
No, I have problems. I never thought in a million years there would be someone running who I'm politically aligned with. So I find this weird position of Dr. West. Do I believe? First of all, if there was ever a time that was ripe for any third party candidate, it is this year because you have two candidates who their own parties don't like, right? And if you look at the disapproval ratings.
Yeah, exactly. They're very, both of them are incredibly unpopular. Yeah.
Yeah. It's ripe, but it's also ripe to build a party. If you get 5%, the Green Party could get funding in the next cycle. If you get 15%, you could turn the debates into Cornell's classroom. So I welcome those types of movement.
Cornell's classroom. Yeah, no. Yeah, I think this country needs six parties. It's ridiculous that we only have two, because two is just not working out. It's just not, you know, all the areas in which they agree, which is like basically corporate power, have been very devastating for most Americans. All right. So the next segment I do is called Right Wing Insanity Roundup. It's always my favorite because we get to have a good laugh at the expense of some crazy stuff. Although some of it is also serious. It's crazy and funny because it is so serious. You're like, are these people serious kind of thing? So the first clip I want to play is Stu Peters. He's talking about staging basically a Georgia coup in response to what's happening with the state RICO charges down in Georgia. So let's play that one.
This demands action, and it demands it right now. So if you live in Georgia, here's what you demand. A special session of the Georgia legislature immediately. Defund the Fulton County DA's office and remove Fannie Willis from power immediately. And if a judge tries to stop you, ignore them. Ignore them. In every other red state, here's what you demand. Cease all cooperation with the federal government on anything. Immediately. No cooperation on any law enforcement. No providing any requested federal data. Treat the Biden regime as, at best, an occupying power in a conquered land. Be defiant.
Okay, there's so much wrong here. I don't even know where to begin. It's hard not to laugh, but no, this guy is serious. And Stu Peters has a very popular show with the right wing. And obviously you can see how people get sucked into more extreme views when they listen to this stuff. But, you know, he's basically calling for a coup, ignore the government. If the judge says this, ignore what the judge says. Treat the federal government as an occupier. And wildly, I want to point out, in many of these red states, quote unquote red states, they're subsidized by federal dollars. For every, you know, $1 that they pay in federal taxes, they're getting back $2. So yeah. They could not exist without that financial support. I don't think Stu cares about that or the poor people in those states. But
does Stu care about the 42 protesters who were arrested on domestic terror charges for having mud on their shoes? No. And that didn't rile them up?
Because, no, of course not. That's the left. It's okay to use law enforcement and the government to go after your political enemies. That's what it's for. Yeah. But if it's coming after you, see, I always explain this to people. The right-wing extremists that are saying these things, they want to get rid of the FBI or they want to defund the police now, whatever. They have very different reasons for wanting to do this. They don't see it as being reform for law enforcement. Like, the left wants to say, like, there's been racial profiling that's harmed Black folks, innocent Black folks have gone to jail, been killed. We shouldn't accept this, right? That's the left. And then the right is basically saying, what is wrong with these guys? They're supposed to be doing our bidding. They're not supposed to be applying universal law universally. They're supposed to be doing what we want them to do.
Like January 6th. That was the same reaction. I'm interviewing people. Why aren't they with us?
Yeah.
And it's interesting. No,
I was just gonna say they don't want reform for the FBI. They want to replace it with Pinochet's army.
And I think that's a really important point, because never before, as a leftist, as someone who's against police terror or covers anti-war protests and believe deeply in it and believe deeply against bombs being dropped all over the world. Because the complete abandonment by the Democratic Party, meaning in Iraq, at least half the Democratic Party wasn't bought off and was against Iraq. Not the Joe Biden half, but half. So you could actually see some mainstream people with you. Now the whole Democrat Party is bought off. 80% of the Republicans are bought off. And the only individuals left are sort of these white supremacist Republicans who are trying to exploit to some people on the left. Say they're anti-war when it's a complete lie. You're a white supremacist. You're not against war. You want to move the bombs from Ukraine and put them either in China or in Middle East or Muslim. I think Tulsi Gabbard is a great example of that.
Yes.
She has cachet. I mean, the first time I heard her speak and I knew nothing about it, I was pumping my fist, because when she's on and she's talking about our coups, right? And then you dig a little deeper, you do a little homework, and this is back when she was on the Democratic Party, you're like, wow, she's real selective in her anti-war. Yeah. She's anti-war on Monday, but on a Tuesday. She's really good with liking drones and bombing Muslims. So you have this faction of that. They're not anti-war. They just want to bomb different people, browner people.
That's right. No, I agree. Yeah. They're not anti-war. No, I think Matthew Heimbach is a prime example of this. This guy has been going to all of these anti... He's a literal neo-Nazi. He used to run the traditional workers' party. So it's weird that he's like trying to invade these left spaces and that some of these supposed lefties are okay with him because of, I don't know, class reductionism. I don't know. They're not educated. I'm going to go with that.
Not.
I'll be charitable, because sometimes I think they do know and they just don't care, and it really bothers me.
Well, the one that bothers me is Tulsi Gabbard. Because I have a lot of friends who I agree with their takes, and they could have a laser focus analysis of maybe AOC and write and look at some of her votes that are wrong and attack her. And they're right about what she voted. But why don't you have that same analysis of Tulsi Gabbard's record? And that's the part that really bothers me, that you have to look at her history and know how pro-war she is.
Right, right. No, and I've interviewed Tulsi a couple times. I think she's definitely shifted far more to the right than she ever was previously. So I don't know what rabbit hole she got sucked into, but boy. All right, so the next is, one of my favorite crazies, Marjorie Taylor Greene, doing her dance around why she can't ever answer a question, Chuck. She gets asked a question and she goes into this like dance and she doesn't answer it and she just says these crazy things. So I think this is a prime example of it.
Congresswoman, do you have a moment?
Yes.
Former President Trump says he received a letter from Jack Smith saying he's a target of a grand jury investigation on January 6th. Do you have a reaction to that?
Yeah, it's absolute bullshit. Yeah, that's my reaction. This is the only way that the Democrats have to beat President Trump is to arrest him, smear him, charge him with ridiculous charges, all in a cover-up of Joe Biden's crimes, Hunter Biden's crimes. It's unbelievable. It's hard to even recognize that this is our country. The American people are going to be furious. And what Jack Smith is doing is the weaponized government. And he's weaponizing the Department of Justice against President Trump in a complete lie about President Trump and January 6th. And it's outrageous. I can't believe our country has to endure this. And I'll be standing with President Trump the entire way.
Have you spoken to him since this?
I have not spoken with him yet, but I'm sure I'll be talking with him very soon.
Given the fact that this is not the first time that he's been the target of all these investigations, do you find this one to be more serious?
Yes, I find it to be more serious because the charges they're looking at bringing against him, they arrested people on January 6th. They held them pre-trial. They never let them out on bail. And is the question that I want to ask Jack Smith, is this the plan? Are they going to arrest President Trump? Trump charge him with phony, fake charges and then hold him in prison while he is winning the Republican primary, while he's going to win the general election in 2024? Is this where our country is now? Because it's an embarrassment on the world stage. If this is the direction America is going in, we are worse than Russia. We are worse than China. We are worse than some of the most corrupt third world countries. And this needs to end. It's an absolute lie. And every single time, President Trump has proven innocent time and time and time again. And he'll be proven innocent again.
He hasn't had a trial, though, right, related to the last indictment.
He shouldn't have a trial related to the last indictment. This is ridiculous.
My favorite, I love what this journalist did there because she's like, time and time again, he's been proven innocent. And the journalist is like, but he hasn't gone to trial ever yet. How has he been proven innocent? And well, he shouldn't go to trial. Like she erupts into her.
He's pretty good at escaping trials. He's very good at that. And this goes back to the 70s.
Right, right.
I was watching McCarthy last week, out of the movie McCarthy, and the link between McCarthy and Trump is Roy Cohn. Roy Cohn, who was the attack dog for McCarthy, was his advisor and lawyer in the 70s. And through Roy Cohn, he learned how to beat everything when he was having racist housing discrimination charges in New York City. And he's really, through that experience, has said, I'll fight everything and I win. And for the most part, he's been pretty successful at it.
He's been very lucky his whole life. I think it's going to finally catch up with him. I wanted to mention, obviously, everything Marjorie Taylor Greene is saying here is ridiculous. She's not addressing the fact there's an ironclad case against him. She's saying they're phony, fake charges, blah, 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 blah. The weaponized DOJ, getting at this, like, I need Pinochet's army, I don't want the FBI to be applying laws universally to everybody, period, end of story. I want them to be biased, and they need to be biased towards what my beliefs are. That's basically what she's saying. But I wanted to mention, so MSNBC had an exclusive recording given to them that came out this morning from a documentarian that had been filming Roger Stone. And this is a really incriminating clip where before the elections even happened, he's talking about the fake electors, how that they've already said he's won the election, he's won the election, so now we're going to push for our fake electors. It didn't even matter to them what the outcome of that election was going to be. These guys were going to keep Trump in power no matter what. This should catch everybody's hair on fire. It just should. Like, this is, you know, some scary fascist stuff going on. So my next clip, Chuck, is just funny as hell. Like, it's okay. Just funny. It's just, I'm going to just leave it at that. Let's go ahead and play it.
Check out his podcast, What the Hell is Going On with Critical Race Theory. It was very good, very informative. Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. On the Princeton point here, you and I have discussed it at the college level. This is fair game. Go ahead and do it, right? I mean, I remember 20 years old going to Trier, Germany, and trying to find the home of Karl Marx because, you know, 1848, he wrote Mein Kampf. I want to know what it was all about. So that's part of the education in America, if you so choose. So that's that. More to come. Green Mile.
As part of the education in America. Yeah.
What? Yeah. You couldn't make this shit up.
No, that is hilarious. Karl Marx wrote Mein Kampf. But here, the bun was kind of funny. The first person starts with the critical race theory.
Right,
and the last
right,
person right. talks about education in America. That's your bun in that statement. And what? Yeah, that's a pretty
And then they shift to, like, Karl Marx wrote Mein Kampf. No, you dumbass. Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. Yeah, Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital.
But, you know, like, some people are going to believe that.
I know,
some
but
people
this
are watching that are going to believe that.
I agree. But they all just pushed it off like it was no big deal. And then they're talking about education in America being bad. It's like, bro, do you hear yourself?
Yeah. I mean, I have a little bit of a sort of a it's not what people want to hear, but Trump is more brazen with his criminality. Let me just put it that he's broken by far and away the most laws, clearly. And he's brazen and he doesn't care.
Right.
So if you're looking domestically or globally, I'm of the opinion that pretty much every president is a criminal just from how we use our military. I mean, the biggest war crime of the century, in my opinion, is Iraq. And that was supported by half the Democrats and Cheney and Bush and all. Yep. And this is, like, we're talking nearly a million people have died because of that.
Yeah. It's heinous. I agree with you. Heinous. I think George W. Bush was worse than Trump for this reason alone. Yeah,
right. And these are heinous things. So I feel, you know, all presidents are war criminals. Certainly what's happening in Palestine, you're signing off. But Trump has a very interesting dynamic. He's a pathological liar at home. We get that. But he's simultaneously the more honest guy globally, meaning every president denies. They say we're spreading democracy around the world. And Trump will be like, you're damn right, we'll take your oil. You know, we're not the good guys. He'll say in the interview, and he'll actually be speaking truth. But what's so interesting is because he believes that. He believes, yes, if they have oil, we should rob them of their oil. Right. And that justifies it. That's good enough. I shouldn't have to make a moral reason. That's how, like, bad he is. The other people trying to cover it up. So what he does.
That's true.
And what he does is he takes that dynamic and he brings it home. And then Americans are like, whoa, it's okay when the president does that to Palestinians or people in Yemen or wherever around the world. Don't do that back here at home.
Right.
Yeah.
No, you're not wrong. All very true. All right. On that note, Chuck, if people want to follow your work, get in touch with you, where can
you do that? Yeah, so I'm at ChuckMoD1 right now. Every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. with WPFW, we do some sports radio. Dave Zirin, Natan Thomas. Also, Dr. West is going to have a kickoff in Mississippi next week. Look for me because I'll be out there in Jackson, Mississippi on the anniversary of Emmett Till. And the Till family will be out there. So I want to interview them as well. I've met a few of the family members. So I think that's going to be good. And just put some of the issues that are out there that are important, that are focused on human rights, that are focused on poor and working people, for the work that you have been doing for a long time now.
Right on. Chuck, is your radio program, is it streamable if you're outside of that area?
Yeah, you could go online, WPFWFM. It's called the collision when sports and politics collide. We get together. So we were talking about Michael Orr today and how he was been treated, the NFL player known in the Blind Side, things like that. We spent most of our time talking about him today.
Very cool. Thanks for joining us, Chuck. I appreciate your time. And as always, you've been very informative and passionate and awesome. And thank you for joining us today.
And I appreciate you, Tina, not because you're just in this booth on the podcast, but you're in the street. And I appreciate it in harm's way.
Yeah, right on.